Hey guys, welcome back to the Science and Religion Podcast. Here with me, Colin Turpin, and my friend Seth Brown.
Hey, how's it going?
So this is week number two. If you're just joining us, go ahead and back up to week one. That was kind of our introduction. We talked about what we were doing, why we were doing it, and kind of how the idea, the thesis of our podcast, of our talking about the intersection of science and religion. And so last week we talked about how difficult it is to define science in broad terms. And so this podcast, we are going to try our hardest to narrow in, to be very specific and very targeted at what we talk about.
Yeah, and I would just like to say real quick that people have been trying to define science and religion for, I don't know, the past 2,000 plus years. I mean, they've been trying to do it for a while, so this is...
But
this,
we're going to get it right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Share with all your friends. You heard a podcast that got it right on science and religion. So I think the purpose behind why we're doing this is that when Colin and I are using terms like science and religion, you will have a reference point to go back to and say, okay, well, when he said science, this is what he meant. This may not apply to definitions of science used elsewhere, but within this local podcast, those definitions of science and religion, we're going to do our best to hold to those.
Yep.
I think that's about it for the
intro. Okay, so let's talk about these definitions. Let's just talk about it.
Yeah.
So
what do we have slated to define?
So first up, we are defining science. We're going to define religion. And then we're going to talk a little bit about naturalism and supernaturalism. What do those things mean? We're going to be using those terms a lot. Before we dive deep into specific topics, let's talk about what we mean when we say them. So, Seth, how would you define science?
Science. Science is... There's, like we've been saying, there's a lot of definitions of science. I'm going to stick with a pretty simple one. From Michael Ruse. Michael Ruse is a philosopher of science. He was famous for testifying on behalf of the plaintiff in the famous Arkansas court case where they ruled against teaching creationism in a classroom. So he said that was a good ruling, and this was kind of the basis for his reason of that. His definition of science, he's speaking of kind of within the context of miracles. Let me pull it up here. He says, but miracles lie outside of science, and then he goes on to define science. Science, which by definition deals with only the natural, the repeatable, and that which is governed by law. So that's Ruse's operating definition of science, and you can actually kind of trace back to that point. He wrote a book called But Is It Science? And with the publication of this book, he really kind of shifted people's view of what science is to this idea of methodological naturalism. And that's a term I'm going to be throwing out a lot.
We're going to talk about that a little bit later.
But keep that in mind, methodological naturalism, we'll get to that. So that's kind of, I really like that definition of science, that which is natural, repeatable, governed by law.
Okay. That's great. So how I've heard it defined is specifically science is a set of methods. So it's things that you do. It's a set of methods designed to describe and interpret observed or inferred phenomena in the past or in the present and aimed at building a testable body of knowledge open to rejection or confirmation by the community. So it's specifically, it's things that you do. It's a set of methods to help, like we talked about last week, understand truth, to help find answers to the why questions. And so it's specifically, it's self-correcting. A lot of people tend to point at science and say, oh, well, this guy was wrong these 300 years ago. Well, turns out that's actually a strength of science, is that it can come back and look at itself and correct and build this testable body of knowledge.
And I think it's important to note one of the last little phrases you used. I actually added this to your definition because I thought it was important. But this idea that it's open to rejection or confirmation by the community. The community, the scientific community is what establishes whether something is scientific or not. And this goes back to authority. I think I mentioned briefly at the very end of last podcast, yes, this idea of authority, in that at some point you have to take someone's authority on just about every subject matter. There's a great quote by Stephen Barr. I'm going to read it real quick. Let me pull it up. He says, "For a person to accept as knowledge only what he had discovered and proved for himself or herself from direct personal experience would put his or her knowledge at the level of the Stone Age." So what he's saying here is that if you were to reject everyone else's authority and only believe what you came to reason for yourself, you would be living in the Stone Age. So it's important to recognize that science, when we're talking about science, it's what the community says is science or isn't science. Now we get into a lot of trouble when we start talking about what the community says is science or isn't science. But it's important to remember that the body of science is collected within a community.
Okay.
And yeah. It's kind of that authoritative community that helps establish what is or isn't science.
Okay, great. So that seems like we have kind of an idea of what science is.
Yeah.
It's a set of methods. It's dealing with the natural. It mm-hmm. is built upon by people in this right. community.
Right. And if you go back in history to the Middle Ages, what was science? Like pre-Middle Ages, what was science? Alchemy, right?
Right.
For them, that was science. That was the community's understanding of what science was, alchemy. Now, we look at that today and go, oh, how quaint, you know.
Yeah,
at least they were trying, you know. but again, that was the community's idea of methods, of right. attempts to understand the world around them.
But we learned that it's not true.
Right.
If anyone wondering, alchemy is not true.
That's right. You can't. What was the big quest? Was the formula for
turning things into gold?
Turning things into
gold. That was the quest. We wanted to get rich, but
there's a great book called The Alchemist. Have you heard of that?
No, I have not.
Paulo Coelho. I don't know if I said that right, and I don't think it has anything to do with science, but so yeah, I hopefully that's a working definition of science that makes sense to you, and as we said, that you know our community today, looking back on that. Set of methods now recognizes that, okay, that wasn't the best way to do science. Hmm. Did we learn from it? Yes.
I would hope so.
And that's kind of the idea that science progresses too as this body of knowledge expands.
Okay, cool. Well, let's move on to religion.
Oh, yes.
What is religion?
Shall we? Why don't you start?
Okay.
With that one?
Wow. Well, first off, it's hard to define.
It is.
It's something that is so big and kind of like science. People think of much different things mm-hmm. based on their background, based on how they have interacted with it. So I've heard it explained. I'm going to kind of do a broad overview and then we're going to narrow in. So overall, it falls into three elements. So first is substantive or what is talking about, kind of how we talked about last week once again of these why questions, how it answers the why questions, mm-hmm. the whatever you want to call it, the theology, the doctrine, the catechism of explaining things. That's a big part of religion. That's why a lot of people turn to it. The second is functional. So this is our behavior, physically what we do with religion. I go to this mosque. I pray this many times a day. I go to this group of people every week. Things like that. The actual physical behavior that comes to religion. That's definitely a part of religion. And lastly, the third element is personal. So these are my individual beliefs, my individual emotions tied to religion, tied to how I've experienced it. That's a part of religion. Mm-hmm. So you can see it when people just throw out this word religion, well, which element are you talking about? Or, you know, it can get confusing very quickly.
Absolutely. Do you have anything else to add?
I think that's okay. It.
I think so. As Colin was saying, that's it's a really, it's a, not a broad definition, but it's a very encompassing definition, in that it's easy to get lost in the weeds with that. And so we kind of talked a little bit beforehand and tried to come up with maybe a more easier way to kind of talk about
more helpful
religion
way,
as it
yeah.
applies to science, because right. after all, this is a science and religion podcast.
Here we are.
So we gotta talk about religion as it relates to science. And so we kind of came up with the idea that when you're talking about religion, especially as it applies to science, religion is a preconceived worldview that you bring to bear on the practice of science. So it is the fundamental operating assumptions that you approach the methods that we were talking about earlier, the set of methods that are used to describe and interpret phenomena that we see in today's world. So the fundamental operating assumptions that you bring to that practice is religion. Is
now hold on. I can hear in my head my friends say, wait a second, you're calling everybody religious. Some people say they're not religious. They don't do it at all. So how could it be that preconceived worldview?
That's a great question. And I think once again, it depends on your definition of religion,
right?
Which we just talked about. And if you talk about those three elements of religion, and you remove kind of the baggage of Christianity or the baggage of Islam, what you have is a very good operating definition of a worldview, right? Mm-hmm. Substantive, what it concerns. What does your worldview concern? Functional, how do you behave as a result of that worldview? And personal, what are your personal and individual beliefs and emotions attached to those two things?
Interesting.
So,
yeah, I like that.
So in that sense, I don't like saying it, but if you strip that definition of religion down to those three elements and hold tightly to those three, in a sense, everyone has their own religion. Everyone has their own beliefs, their own worldview. Now, when you start applying it more specifically to Christianity, you can get a little more detailed with your definitions. But that's what we kind of mean by religion.
Yes.
Would you?
I totally
you
agree.
Don't
yeah. No, you did a great job okay, explaining
good.
That. Yeah.
Good. So hopefully that helps when we talk about religion. Let's move on to naturalism and supernaturalism.
Okay.
Okay, this one's interesting. This is... Why don't you lead with what you came up with, and then I'll kind of respond with Ruse's methodological naturalism.
So essentially, the natural world are things that are observable and measurable. Things that are repeatably observable and measurable. So everything we see around us, phenomena like gravity, things that we can take and look at and find repeatable evidence to prove or disprove them. So in this natural world, is everything that you see around you, that's how we operate in our lives. Currently, science is reigning supreme. Science is the best thing mm-hmm. that humans have determined to understand our natural world. We've had other ways of trying to explain it, like we mentioned earlier about alchemy, that were proven wrong. So right now, science is the best way that we have to understand and interact with our natural world.
The natural world.
The natural world, yes. The things that are repeatably observable and measurable, yes.
Right. Absolutely. And so I'd like to distinguish just briefly here. That was a pretty general definition of naturalism, and I kind of want to go a little deeper and see how that applies to specific worldviews. So a big topic of conversation that we'll get to here in a bit is what is the best way to do science? How do we do science effectively?
Hmm.
And there's a lot of talk out there about what's the best preconceived worldview that you can bring to bear on science that will give you the most advances, the most findings, so on and so forth. As I was saying earlier, Michael Ruse argues that methodological naturalism is the best operating assumption that you can have for doing science. Now, methodological naturalism says that, again, that the best way to do science is to assume that there is only natural explanations for things. So this rules out explanations of God intervening directly in the world. This rules out the supernatural. This assumes that when you're doing science, there are only natural explanations.
How would that help in science?
So what that does is it helps systematize the way you go about science. If everyone is operating with the same assumptions, you can talk across the world using the same assumptions. And this goes back to what the community says. The community right now, the scientific community, says that methodological naturalism is the best way to do science. And so if you're attempting to add knowledge to that body, that community, it's really hard to prove something outside of that assumption and have it be accepted. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So in a sense, it standardizes the way we do science.
Great.
And in that sense, it's very helpful. It makes the world explainable. It gives us the ability to say, we may not know how that phenomena works now, but there is a natural explanation for
right.
it.
Right, yes.
Now, this is it's important to distinguish between this idea, methodological naturalism, and metaphysical naturalism.
What does that mean?
So there's some big words. It's really not too complicated. Methodological naturalism says, look, it doesn't matter what your worldview says, this is the best way to go about it. You can believe something else, but when you do science, this is the best way to do it. Methodological naturalism. Metaphysical naturalism has to do with your worldview, the preconceived notion that you bring to science. And that is the atheistic kind of, there is only natural things in this world. So Ruse distinguishes between methodological and metaphysical naturalism in that way.
So it almost sounds like last week when we were talking about conflict versus independence. So it sounds like one is specifically, the metaphysical is targeted against religion, is saying
right.
there can't be.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And methodological naturalism is more of the independence mm-hmm. of saying
right, absolutely.
Whatever you believe, leave it at the door before you come inside.
Absolutely. That's a really good way of explaining it. So that's kind of naturalism. Lots of terms, definitions to maybe get you thinking about what is natural, what is not.
And even what are your own worldviews right, that you're bringing into. And well, I was going to say this earlier. I totally forgot. Who is this scientific community? Who are scientists? Do you need a lab coat to do science?
That's what I thought, right?
It surely can't hurt.
I've got a lab coat, though, so hang up in my closet.
If we're looking at science as a way to build a testable body of knowledge, it's kind of hard for anyone and everyone to help contribute. I mean, unless you want to start publishing papers, which right. go ahead, by all means. But specifically, I want you guys to think about how you are answering the questions, the why questions. How you are seeking truth, whatever that means to you in whatever field. Because like I said earlier, if you're dealing with natural things, science is the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot easier to be a scientist. Doing science, doing good science is hard, but it's a lot easier to employ these methods than one might think.
Right.
And so no matter what worldview you have, the way you are applying it almost to the natural world, to answering questions, that is the way that you're doing science.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
I think so.
Great.
So let's move on to supernatural.
Let's move on to supernatural. Ooh.
Yeah, this one was tough. This one, Colin and I sat and talked for a while about how we were going to explain supernaturalism. And Colin came up with the best idea, so I'm just going to shove that responsibility onto him.
So if we talked about naturalism, the natural world, being things, like I said earlier, that are repeatably observed or measured. That by definition leaves supernaturalism to phenomena that are not repeatably observed or measured. And it gets really tricky because as soon as you get to specific examples and look at things, you are now observing it and measuring it, and that makes it natural.
Right.
So,
well, I think the tricky thing is, how do you quantify that?
Okay,
sure. How do you further quantify that? In the natural world, you can quantify things with units, speeds, distances, weights, joules, energy, so on and so forth. Well, how do you quantify something like morality? Can you put morality on a scale that is standardized for everyone?
Or how about something like beauty?
Yeah.
Or aesthetics?
I'll tell you, I used to hate Pablo Picasso's work, and now I actually really like it. But I guarantee you, there are people out there that would look at his work and say, that's not beauty. Like, that's... So supernatural is, how do you quantify that?
Right.
We can't, I would say. Would you agree?
It's how we're doing our science right now. You can't plug that into an experiment and have an independent sample.
Right.
You can say observe people and look at how people interact to things, but you're not really observing the things themselves. You're observing the people.
Yeah.
So it gets really hard when you're trying to define supernatural.
I do want to say, though, that there are these... I was talking with a friend a long time ago, and apparently people have come up with units of happiness.
What?
Yeah, it's kind of a joke, but I'll look it up. We'll move on. You've got a little spiel to go over for human perception,
okay,
right?
Okay, yes.
Why don't you take over, and I'll try to find the units of happiness.
Okay, so now thinking, let's take a step back. We've been in the bushes, in the weeds, talking through some definitions. So this week we are talking about the supernatural and the natural world and how those worlds collide and what that looks like. And so my question to you guys that I thought of a while ago, or I had to process through, I didn't come up with it, is this idea of, okay, is this even possible? Is there even a possibility that things happen outside of our natural world? Because like we said earlier, once you look at something, it's now observable, and that, by our definition, makes it natural. So what does... is there even a possibility of things existing outside of it? So in order to answer that question, you're going to have to bear with me. It might get a little bit like the Matrix.
I love that.
Here. So we're talking about human perception, about how you as a person can see things and understand them. So essentially, the short of it is, we don't see the world as it is. We have... our senses, seeing, hearing, balance, things like that, our ways of interacting with the world, and our bodies amazingly take all of that information coming in and somehow piece it together into our conscious experience. So we don't actually see the things outside of us as they are. We are seeing our brain that recreates it into this consciousness, this experience that we're having. An easy way to think about this is my roommate who is colorblind. I have a colorblind roommate who his perceptual reality is entirely different. Anyone who is colorblind is an easy example to think of, where we're looking at the same things, but what he's experiencing is entirely different than what I am. And so that begs a lot of these really heavy psychological questions that we don't have time to go into. But essentially, there's a great quote by Anais Nin, which is we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. So whatever you are bringing to this perceptual reality, that's how you're experiencing it. So why am I mentioning these things? It's kind of weird. So the reason why I bring this up is that there are phenomena that occur outside of our perceptual reality. Stuff like radio waves is electromagnetic wave that's not on the visible spectrum. It exists outside of that. We can record it. We can measure it. Mm-hmm. Things like radiation, things like germs. People didn't know they existed because it's really hard to see them, yeah. Right? We have to build devices in order to detect these things. So we know for a fact that there are things going on outside of our perceptual reality. So that begs the question is, what is out there that we can't detect yet? Or what is out there that we may never detect? Just because we're not perceiving it with our senses or with our devices doesn't mean it's not there. So to answer the question of, is it even possible to have a supernatural world? Well, the answer is maybe.
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. I would say it is a possibility.
Yeah.
But how do you figure it out?
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's good. That's really interesting, and I think that's really important to remember. I love that. What was that quote? The way we see things are not how they are.
We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are.
Right. Yeah. And so that, again, this goes back to this idea of religion, or whatever you want to call it, your worldview, as something that you bring to bear on the practice of science. Two people with different worldviews can look at the same data, the same thing, and because of how they are, what their beliefs are, they interpret it differently. They have a different experiential reality of that data. Not that that's a direct application to that quote or a direct line from that quote to that idea, but that's kind of the idea that we're getting at. Is that? Right. Anyways, that's really fascinating. I'd like to tackle one more thing, and then we'll end with a preview of next week, which we're really excited about. So a couple minutes ago, 5 to 10 minutes ago, I was talking about how methodological naturalism is the best way to do science. I said that. I remember saying that. And as I said that, I personally, and I'm sure some of our listeners, probably had the gut reaction of, well, why?
Why
is it? Why can't I assume that there is a God? Why can't I bring that God into my hypotheses? Why can't I use him to inform my understanding?
It's a great question.
Well, so this gets into the whole argument of science stoppers. And this is, I think, hopefully I'll be able to provide both sides of this argument equally, and you can kind of see for yourself what the best way to proceed is. So there's these two philosophers, I've mentioned them already, one of them already, Michael Ruse, and then the other one is Alvin Plantinga. Alvin Plantinga is a theist, he's a Christian theist. In fact, I read that he was a Calvinist, so that may give you a little more information for those of you who are familiar with Calvinism. So he's writing, and he's attacking this idea that methodological naturalism is the best way to go about things. He doesn't like that. He says, why can't I let my belief in God inform the way I see the world? So he points to Ruse's definition and says, your definition is, in a sense, a science stopper. Now, a science stopper, it's important to note, is something that kind of halts the scientific progress, right? So a great example of this in favor of atheism is Christians who say, well, you know, the beginning of the world, that God just made it that way. He made the world, he created it, and it's just that way. That's how it is.
I know that's what it is.
I know that's what it is.
Right.
Well, that's a science stopper in the sense that if God acts directly at one time in the world as we see it today, how are we going to repeat that? How are we going to measure that? How are we going to quantify that creative action? We can't. We can't. It would be a miracle, and that, in a sense, stops the scientific discovery of the natural world. And so that is a science stopper. Well, Plantinga is kind of turning that on its head, and he says, look, no. Your definition of methodological naturalism is a science stopper because it limits the explanation of the world we see it today to only natural causes. They may have been natural. For all we know, they may have been, but they may not have been. And this goes to your quote about supernatural. Well, maybe there is a supernatural world. We don't know, but why would you limit yourself necessarily to just one explanation of it? Barr has a great quote. Again, I'm going to read it. We're kind of running out of time, but Barr says, not only is materialism, read here as methodological naturalism, so not only is methodological naturalism, as it is usually encountered, more fideistic than the faith of the ordinary religious believer, and here's the good part, it is also far more narrow and intellectually confining. Nothing is allowed by him to be explained to be beyond explanation in terms of matter and the mathematical laws it obeys. So on one side, you have theist attacking this idea and saying, look, that idea of methodological naturalism is too narrow. That definition isn't, in a sense, a science stopper because it limits the explanation of the world as we see it, right?
Yeah.
Well, Ruse responds and basically says what I mentioned earlier. That is, he kind of responds in two ways. One, the best way that we have done science, historically speaking, methodological naturalism. Like, you may not agree with it, but that's the most effective way. And if you want to speak to this community, the scientific community, who accepts methodological naturalism, then that's the best way you're going to get science done. You may not agree with it, but that's the best way. So live with it and do science that way. But he also points again to the God of the Gaps theology. Now, what I mean here is what I was talking about earlier. That is, if we see a phenomenon that we can't explain just yet, our natural conclusion cannot be, oh, God just made it that way.
I don't know, therefore
God. I don't know, therefore God.
Right.
That stops science. And it diminishes, in a lot of people's minds, the power of God. So say, for example, you said that, I don't know, but God. Well, what happens to your God when an explanation does arise?
Right.
Well, then it's like, well, that God, we don't need him anymore because we have this. And so then you keep squeezing this God of the gaps into a tinier and tinier box until maybe there is no God, right? I just kind of wanted to give you the background of those two arguments to help you understand the overall argument behind what is the best way to do science. When we're talking about terms, definitions, science, religion, what's the best way to go about science, practicing science? Today, most people say methodological naturalism, but some people say there's better options. Hopefully I've given you both sides and you can kind of think through that yourself.
And these are some themes that will come up once we start digging into specific intersections.
Oh, absolutely.
Of science and religion. Yeah. You'll see these same topics pop up and up again.
So, absolutely.
Keep them in mind. Think about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's what we want you to do. Think about it. Discuss it with a friend. There's something about talking out loud through these things with someone that helps, really helps clarify it in your own mind.
Absolutely.
So next week, we're going to be talking about justified beliefs, right?
That's right. So the question is, now that we know why we're talking about, now that we kind of know this week what we're talking about, the next question is, how do you know what you believe?
Yeah.
Why do you believe the things that you believe?
Right. And we, as we were kind of just preliminarily talking through this, we found a great quote from St. Thomas Aquinas. He was a famous Christian in the Middle Ages. He was the dude back in the Middle Ages. And even still today, a lot of Christians point to his thoughts and his ideas as being very relevant. And in fact, the quote we have, like you were saying before the show began, it was written just about 1,000 years ago, but it is eerie how relevant it is for today. And this quote is written to Christians, but I think it's good for non-Christians to hear this, for those who don't believe in Christianity, because you can quote it to your Christian friends and see how they respond.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, Augustine, St. Augustine, another famous Christian father, he teaches that two points should be kept in mind when resolving such questions of interpreting Scripture. First, the truth of Scripture must be held inviolably. Second, when there are different ways of explaining a scriptural text, no particular explanation should be held so rigidly that if convincing arguments show it to be false, anyone dare to insist that it is still the definitive sense of the text. And so the idea behind that quote is, when there's an argument against a certain interpretation of Scripture, should you believe that interpretation anymore? Why should you believe that?
Why should you?
So it fits quite nicely with this idea, justified beliefs. That's all we've got for today. We ran a little long, but that's okay. Colin, you got any closing thoughts?
Thank you guys for sticking with us. We are having a blast doing
this. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I get really excited.
So looking forward to talking to you again next week.
Absolutely.